Hello and welcome to Sola Christian Fellowship. As a church, we seek to prioritize the Word of God, to provide for the family, to promote good in our community, to produce leaders, and to plant seeds. Join us as we unpack the Word of God today.
So this week and next week, we'll be in Ruth. We'll finish up Ruth next week. And then we'll talk about April, what we're going to do in April, kind of at the end of today. But today we're going to cover Ruth chapter 4, verses 13 through 17. And last week, we saw this redemption of Naomi and Ruth come to fruition, that Boaz had made this commitment to them that he would make sure that one way or the other, that their redemption would happen, that he would get this thing done. And Naomi had this faith in him, and Ruth kind of is patiently waiting there to see what's going to happen next. And then we see that he does get it done, right? That there's this weird sandal swapping thing going on, and this covenant is made, and the redemption is complete. It's affirmed by the elders. And as the book of Ruth tends to do, it's these time warp things where last week it was a detailed kind of play-by-play, and there's dialogue and there's events happening and this whole thing is unfolding in a very slow fashion. And then this week we start out with one verse that probably encompasses a year's time. There's a wedding and there's a pregnancy and there's a son born, and it's all in one verse. And it's strange how the book swings like that. So let's pick up at verse 13, read 13 through 17. So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife, and he went into her, and the Lord gave her conception, and she bore a son. Then the women said to Naomi, "Blessed be the Lord, who has not left you this day without a redeemer, and may his name be renowned in Israel. He shall be to you a restorer of life and a nourisher of your old age, for your daughter-in-law, who loves you, is more to you than seven sons, has given birth to him." Then Naomi took the child and laid him on her lap and became his nurse. Verse 17, and the women of the neighborhood gave him a name, saying, "A son has been born to Naomi," and they named him Obed. He was the father of Jesse, the father of David. God, we thank you for your word. We thank you that we can come together and study these words that you give us, that we can understand more of who you are and what your plan is. And God, I just ask that you help us to be shaped by these words. Help us to have a change of thought, a change of direction, a change of attitude, a change in our hearts based on the words of your truth. In Jesus' name, amen. So verse 13, a year probably wrapped up in at least 9 months, right? It wrapped up into this one little verse that Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife, and he went into her, and the Lord gave her conception, and she bore a son. One important, very important, I think, note is right square in the middle of that the Lord gave her conception. Because children are a blessing from God. There's countless places in the Bible, we'll hit on a few of these, where the Lord is attributed with creating life, with giving a child. One of those kind of wraps up into verse Psalm 127. It starts at verse 1. I'm going to read through verse 5 in there. It says, "Unless the Lord builds the house, those who build it labor in vain. Unless the Lord watches over the city, the watchman stays awake in vain. It is in vain that you rise up early and go late to rest, eating the bread of anxious toil, for he gives to his beloved sleep." Verse 3 says, "Behold, children are a heritage from the Lord, the fruit of the womb a reward. Like arrows in the hand of a warrior are the children of one's youth. Blessed is the man who fills his quiver with them. He shall not be put to shame when he speaks with his enemies in the gate." This idea that God gives this blessing of life, this blessing of family, this blessing of children shouldn't be missed, I don't think, in this story that we unfold around Ruth and Naomi and Boaz. It's not a story that we should miss in our lives. That there was this time kind of before the miracle of modern medicine, before the advancements that we have in science, when I think God got a lot more credit for creating life than he does today, which is an unfortunate thing, really, that I'm afraid that all too often anymore that the creation of a new life isn't really seen too much as a blessing from God, so much as a consequence of science, right? An event of biology. It's just what happens. It's not a miracle. Sometimes even it's a burden. It's a disease. It's something to be taken care of, not something to be celebrated. There was a time before this modern age of medicine that we have where they couldn't explain necessarily how all these things worked. I mean, they understood the general concept of how things happen, but they couldn't go to a lab and reproduce it. They couldn't document it with ultrasounds and scientific facts and all these things. So it was kind of a surprise. It was kind of a, even not that long ago, right? You couldn't go get an ultrasound and know the gender of a child to be born before they were born. It was really a surprise to see what's going to happen. A lot of that's changed. And I think maybe to our detriment that when modern man has the ability to more or less create life, when it becomes our function that we can do this and it's ours, we created this life and we sustain this life, we can also decide when this life should no longer be sustained, which is sad and scary to think how far that progression needs to go before it really, 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 really gets bad. I think it's tough for us to think about, maybe we should think about it more, though, that we're not the creators of life. We're not the sustainers of these things. We might be able to explain biological functions and whatnot, but God created those processes too. And they don't happen without God moving something to make things happen. There aren't accidents, right? As adults, as grown-ups, we screw stuff up. We make bad choices. We don't think things through, but there are no accidents when it comes to what God does. If the verses we read in Colossians last week, this is chapter 1, 14 through 17. I'm sorry, 15 through 17. If these are true from last week, that he is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation, for by him all things were created in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities. All things were created through him and for him. And he is before all things, and in him all things hold together. If that's true, that God creates all things and God holds all things together, then none of us, none of the people who have ever walked the earth were a mistake or an accident or an unplanned event. Maybe unplanned by their parents, but not unplanned by God. Romans 8:28. I think we hit on that last week, didn't we? It was on the bookmark, wasn't it? We know that all things work for those who love God. We know that for those who love God, all things work together for the good, for those who are called according to his purpose. And I don't think we can really ponder those kind of verses and these kind of ideas and not just ask the question of, if that's true, then why, right? Why does bad stuff happen? Why does God create a life and a child to be born when he knows that that child is going to be killed by an abortion doctor? Or neglected, or abused, or whatever, right? We can't be thinkers through these things and not think about the implications of why. If God has a master plan, why does it seem like sometimes that really sucks, right? I really don't have the answers to that. It really does relate to this story of Ruth, though. I think as we think through these verses, we can't be surprised that sinners in a sinful world that are affected by sin, somehow or another God is still in charge and God is still doing what God does. God is the creator of all, right? All are part of God's plan. Boaz was, obviously Ruth was, Naomi was, you are and I am, and all of the people who have walked the earth are, that God is creator. He is the giver of life, the sustainer of the world. He is the King of kings and the Lord of all. And all of those things are the things that none of us are called to be, right? We are never called to be the creator of life and the giver of all things, the sustainer of the world. We're not called to be kings or Lord. What we are called to be are his people who are called to his name, his people who are called to do his will, to do his work. One other thing he doesn't ever call us to is to understand all of the things of the world and how they work together. That's not our job, to know all the details and the ins and outs and how all the puzzle pieces fit together to make one big picture. We're called to trust in him who is greater, who is stronger, who is higher. We are called to have faith in this great I Am that is doing something that's been planned since the beginning of time, that even though we might make mistakes, we might screw things up, we might be poor planners sometimes at life, all of this world has been a plan that God has had, that he has unfolded since the beginning of time, and we are supposed to trust in that. That's the idea of faith, right? The Hebrews 1:11 tells us that faith is hoping. Now, faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. You think about Ruth and Naomi and all the life events that have kind of unfolded in this little story as we've followed this along. And really, we've probably covered 15, 20, maybe 25 years in the run of this book, right? As we look at these things happening, there's a lot of life that has fallen on these people, right? Deaths of spouses, deaths of children, famines, starving, uncertainty, lots of drama and tragedy. And going into last week, the future looks pretty bleak still for these two, right? This future ahead of them is going to be rough. It's going to be hungry. It's going to be a lot of hard work, and eventually they're going to die. And when these two ladies die, what's left? There's no legacy, right? There's no family to carry on, a name or anything. When these two are gone, that's it. And that's not the future that any of us look forward to, is just to be the end, right? But that's not the plan. That's not what's going on. And we can't help but see this sovereign hand of God, this hand of the Almighty that's moving through this whole story to make something greater, something bigger happen, something else unfold than what we really see in the beginning parts of it. And you think about Ruth, right? She's given conception by the Lord. She bears a son for Boaz. She's married once before, right? She's married to Mahlon, Naomi's son, for maybe 10 years. Like, we're not really given a timeline on that, but based on the language, it's probably a good long time that these two are married. And so we have to ask the question, either they didn't figure out what they were supposed to be doing, or they figured it out and it didn't work. One of the two, right? For some reason, she never conceives before this time, and she marries Boaz, and they have a son. That's the hand of God moving, right? That God opens the womb. God gives conception. God grants this child to these two because it's part of his plan. And I think if we're more prone to recognize that, if we maybe shift our minds to think about it, maybe even to pray about, God, help me to recognize your hand in all these things, that when there is an event in life that's wonderful to celebrate, like the birth of a child, or even the scarier times or the harder times, that we recognize the sovereign hand of God is moving through these things to do something that's great because it's part of his will. Maybe if we look more at God the Creator and God the Sustainer and God the Lord over all, we'll cherish maybe all of these things that come into play. But just like that, in that first verse, there's a wedding. There's at least 9 months in between there, and there's the birth of a son. One verse, lots of time. Verse 14 then, it says, "The women said to Naomi, 'Blessed be the Lord who has not left you this day without a redeemer, and may his name be renowned in Israel. He shall be to you a restorer of life and a nourisher in your old age. For your daughter-in-law who loves you is more to you than 7 sons, has given birth to him.'" I told Casey the other day, Ruth is worth 7 sons as I watched 2 sons carry a couch. It's like, man, Ruth is a hoss. But no, that really was. I really did tell her that, though. I was glad to have 2 sons when there was a couch to carry. They weren't. They weren't as excited. There's a contrast to make, though, I think, in this little, in 14 and 15 with going back into chapter 1 of Ruth to verse 19, 20, and 21. There's these two scenes of the community, of the women talking, and Naomi as kind of the subject of their conversation. I'll read these to you in chapter 1, verses 19, 20, and 21. It says the two of them went on until they came to Bethlehem. And when they came to Bethlehem, the whole town was stirred because of them. And the women said, "Is this Naomi?" And she said to them, "Do not call me Naomi, call me Mara. For the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. I went away full, and the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi when the Lord has testified against me and the Almighty has brought calamity upon me?" See, back in chapter 1, the women are saying this of Naomi, right? They don't ask her, "Hey, are you Naomi?" No, they say, "Is that Naomi?" Right? They're talking of her. They're talking about her, not with her. She responds, but it's not really a conversation so much as this time they're talking to her. Conversation with her in chapter 4, that now we're more of a peer relationship than just talking about someone. In chapter 1, she's blaming God for ruining her life, right? She went away full and she came back empty. Her name means pleasant and she doesn't want to be called that anymore because she's bitter and old and changed. But these women say to Naomi, "Blessed be the Lord." Because of what God has done, bless God for what He has done in her life. Blessed be the Lord who gets the glory. There's a very similar scene. We're going to make a couple of connections to that story in Luke chapter 1 where Elizabeth has a son. Y'all remember that when we studied around the Christmas time. In Luke chapter 1, there's this scene where Elizabeth and Zechariah, who are older, past the years of childbearing, have never had any children at all. And then all of a sudden, a son is given to them that Elizabeth becomes pregnant, right, in her old age. And she has a son, and his name is John. And the whole community comes together, y'all remember, to celebrate what God has done in the lives of these two. It's a very similar connection to what's happened in this community in the Old Testament. It's a very vivid picture, I think, of what the church is supposed to be. That it's a community that comes together in the good things. It's a community that comes together also in the bad things, right? When life goes south, it's the community that binds around each other. When life is going good, it's the community that celebrates together the good things that are going on. 1 Corinthians 12, 26 and 27, describing the church, the New Testament church, it says, "If one member suffers, all suffer together. If one member is honored, all rejoice together. Now you are the body of Christ and individually members of it." Romans 12, 15, it tells us, "Rejoice with those who rejoice and weep with those who weep." The devotional this week kind of goes a lot more into that, the connections between the church, the New Testament, New Covenant church, the church that we are part of today, and this Old Testament community of Israel, the people of God in that time. So make sure you grab one of those. But that community, that people of God, they would come together to rejoice, right? They would come together to celebrate these events of life in the community around them as one big kind of family together. It's this picture that's painted that when someone in the community rejoices, we all rejoice together. The woman said to Naomi, "Blessed be the Lord who has not left you this day without a redeemer, and may his name be renowned in all Israel. He shall be to you a restorer of life and a nourisher in your old age. For your daughter-in-law who loves you, who is more to you than seven sons, has given birth to him." The Lord, it says, has not left you without a redeemer. And this becomes an interesting question in the text as we kind of unpack the way these verses, these words are constructed. Because there's a kind of a question in the language about who this redeemer would be. Right? The Lord has not left you without a redeemer. Kind of to make sense of some of this, we look back at verse 11 and 12 of chapter 4 from last week, when Boaz is talking to the elders to find out who is the redeemer and whose name is being referred to in this. Verse 11 says, "Then all the people who were at the gate and the elders said, 'We are witnesses.'" Right, this is after the deal has been made. They swapped sandals and the deal's made, right? "We are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your house like Rachel and Leah, who together built up the house of Israel. May you act worthily in Ephrathah and be renowned in Bethlehem. And may your house be like the house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah, because of the offspring that the Lord will give you by this young woman." Right, those elders' comments were directed at Boaz, that he would act worthily, that he would be renowned in Bethlehem. And now when the women speak to Naomi about this redeemer, They kind of amplify this thing. May the son's name be renowned, right? But more so in all Israel, not just Bethlehem as it was given to Boaz, not just regionally, but kind of nationally, may he be known. This is a bigger deal. That if Boaz is to be well known, then this son, this redeemer that's born that it's describing is to be famous, more or less. Like, Boaz, you're pretty good, but this one's going to be great because of what God has done. Now, redeemer, it's interesting to really look at how this is structured through here, because all along we've been building up to this Boaz being called the redeemer, right? He was the kinsman redeemer. There was another redeemer that was nearer to him that had this first right of refusal. And the whole scene kind of unfolds that Boaz redeems Naomi and the land, and Ruth comes as part of this package deal. But when the ultimate redeemer is described in these words, when Naomi is talking with the women, the redeemer who is going to be her legacy is not Boaz. It's the son that is born. It's the one who has come into the family to carry their name on, to take forward what's been lost. The son is the redeemer, not Boaz. And ultimately, like if we really break this thing down, we look at it, the ultimate redeemer, of course, we know is God. Like that Christ would redeem us, and that God even is the giver of this redeemer, this child born, who is going to carry on the legacy, who's going to redeem, who's going to do all the things that were lost when Naomi's sons were killed before. The giver of all good things is the Lord. He is the creator of life, the sustainer of the universe. Right? He's the one that called them. He's the one that calls us. He's the one that saved them. He's the one that saves us. It is in Him that we live and move and breathe. It's Him that we worship. Colossians 3, 1 through 4, it tells us, if you have been raised in Christ, seek the things that are above, where Christ is, seated at the right hand of God. Set your minds on things that are above, not on things that are on the earth. For you have died, and your life is hidden with Christ in God. When Christ, who is your life, appears, you will also appear with Him in glory. See, that's our Redeemer. Our Redeemer is this Son born, right? This Son given that He could come and redeem us to restore all things that were lost, to bring us back into the family that we were dropped out of in our sinfulness. There's a huge connection, I think, between these two, to see Boaz having a son and his son being given as the Redeemer of the lost, right? And God the Father having a son and his son being given as the Redeemer for his people forever. Maybe it's a stretch, but I don't think it's a stretch to see the picture of these two things painted, that it's an image of what's going to come. Like the real people, it's a real story, it's a real life. But we are redeemed in the Son who is Christ, bringing us back to the place that we were lost from. It says, he will be to you a restorer of life, a nourisher in your old age. For your daughter-in-law who loves you, who is more to you than seven sons, has given birth to him. Then Naomi took the child and laid him on her lap and became his nurse. And I don't want to miss just the kind of the human emotion part of that, right? This isn't the first child that Naomi held, for sure, right? She had two sons before him. Surely there's been other people around, right? But this is different, right? This is a restorative thing, right? It's if you've ever been injured and lost use of your hand or your foot or some part of your body for a while, you've been sick and you couldn't do anything, and then you recover from that, your kind of life is restored and you get that back. Or maybe you've been in a situation where someone in the family was supposed to die, right? Like the doctor said, this is it, and then they didn't, right? And you got 5 more years, 10 more years with that person. There's the loss, the feeling of the loss, and there's this restoration that something greater has happened. I think that's really a sense that we can get out of this tenderness where Naomi takes the child and she lays him on her lap and she becomes his nurse. We can only wonder what she's thinking of as she holds that baby, right? This grandson, if you will, but this so much more than that, this redeemer that they're given. Everything looked bleak and lost and hopeless, and now we have this, right? This is not the plan. This is not the direction we thought this was going to go. I wonder what she would do if she could turn back time at that point, right? Like surely if she could have turned back time a couple of years before and never having gone to Moab during the famine. Maybe if they had just stayed in Bethlehem, things would have been different. She wouldn't have lost her family. Maybe it would have been better. I wonder now, though, now that everything has kind of come full circle as she holds that child, if she would go back and do it all again the same way. Because we have those times, right, where maybe in the moment we wish we'd have never been here, but years later, we know I would do every bit of that the exact same way again, even the hardest parts of it, because of where it came out on the other end of this. Now holding that child, I just wonder, like the single most important thing in her life, nothing else could be better. Nothing else could be sought after. There's no greener grass to go find now. Naomi's landed, right? She's different. Different than she was when she arrived back in Bethlehem. I think absolutely different than she was when she left Bethlehem so many years before to go to Moab to find something better. Verse 17, it says, all the women in the neighborhood gave him a name, saying, a son has been born to Naomi. They named him Obed. He was the father of Jesse, the father of David. And we'll look next week. There's a few more verses after this that kind of repeat that lineage. We'll look at those next week because it's pretty interesting to see how that stacks out. But you notice right there, the women of the neighborhood gave him a name. See, his name's going to be Obed, which was not really a common thing to happen. It was not that normal that the non-family, right, that the women of the neighborhood would come along and give somebody else's kid a name. We saw that happen in another connection to John the Baptist. We saw that happen whenever they have this child and Elizabeth says, his name is John. And they're like, no, it's not. His name is not John because his dad's name is not John and nobody else related to you, his name is John. So he can't be named John. And she's like, no, his name is John. And y'all remember, Zechariah is mute at this point. He couldn't talk the whole pregnancy. Y'all remember how that all worked out. And they give him a piece of paper and he writes, the child's name is John on the paper, right? And they're like, oh. And then he could talk again. But it sticks, right? The community didn't get to name that kid. God named that kid. It was not a common thing. Interesting, though, in this little piece right here, that name Obed, it means servant. Some commentators say it's probably short for Obadiah. Maybe it is, maybe it's not. Obadiah means servant of the Lord, servant of Yahweh. The text doesn't really tell us that. It just gives the name Obed. And it's interesting, too, that there are no indications at all anywhere in the text of other kids being born to Boaz and Ruth. Like, we don't know. Maybe they did. There's no documentation at all that there were any kids otherwise born to these two after this one. This is the only son, as far as we know, which is another one of these really interesting connections to this story of John the Baptist, for sure, right? This only son that's given. And then certainly the story of the Messiah, right? The Son of God given to be the Redeemer, the Restorer. And maybe there were others. We just don't know. But this Obed, he's the father of Jesse. Y'all know Jesse was a shepherd and he had several sons. There's a really interesting connection. And this gets into that a little bit of that extra biblical legend of what the Jews had for Ruth and Orpah, jumping back several weeks, right? There's this weird story in the Jewish legend when Ruth goes on with Naomi and they go back to Bethlehem, and Orpah, the other daughter-in-law, goes back to Moab. Legend holds that she had four sons, right? And these four sons are giants, like literal giants. They're huge. One of those sons has a name that we're all familiar with, Goliath, as the legend goes, right? So this Jesse, who's the son of Obed, he has a son, and his name is David, right? And who kills Goliath? David, right? It's the same people in this storyline as the lines come back together and clash. There's a really interesting connection, too, and this is really kind of reaching out there. There's a really interesting kind of connection, though, when you look at way back in Genesis, was it chapter 6, chapter 5, chapter 4, somewhere in there, where the Nephilim are mentioned, and it's before the flood, and there's these giants that it talks about, right? And they're taking the daughters, and they're having these giant, mighty, powerful sons with them, right? And there's this whole battle going on for the spiritual well-being of the people, and God wipes the whole thing out. There's this recurring kind of cycle of these giants, if you will, coming back against the righteous line that God is producing here and clashing with them. And that's really not our topic for today, but that's a thing. Y'all can go read about it. We're still fighting giants, right? Yeah, maybe they don't look so big, but they sure do act big, right? Yeah. Yeah, there's always, always a battle against doing what God calls us to do. Always. The father of David, that's Jesse, he has this servant boy, this child who, we'll get into this more next week really, but just briefly to kind of connect these dots, like Ruth was not the one we would expect, right? If we were stacking up a team of people to build out this story, we wouldn't take the Moabite widow girl and bring her in, right? That's not, doesn't fit the good mold here, right? And she has a son, and the son's name is Obed, and he's not the one that we would probably think to be the Redeemer if we were making this story up, right? It would be the powerful Boaz, the mighty man of valor, right? But it's this child, this baby born. The story doesn't quit like that, though. As we go through that line, you come to this scene where Jesse's called to bring all of his sons to the table because one of them is going to be named a king. And so he brings the boys in, and the guy goes through, and he's like, none of these are supposed to be the king. Where's the other one? And Jesse, the dad, he's like, no, you don't want him. He's a runt. He's scrawny. We left him out there to watch the sheep because somebody's got to do it. It's the one that you're not suspecting is going to be picked that's the king. Right? This underdog story keeps repeating and repeating and repeating through here. It's the same idea that David, the shepherd boy who's not worthy for a seat at the table, becomes the one that defeats the giant that's threatening God's people. He becomes the one that's crowned king of Israel who nobody would have suspected at all. I think part of what sticks out of the story of Ruth and connects these ideas together and hopefully sticks to something in our lives is this faithfulness of God. That there are times when everything in this story, for sure, seems hopeless. There's times when we're fighting the giants in our life where it just seems hopeless, like this can't be the way it's supposed to work out. This is not the way that God would do this. If I was God, let me tell you, I would do this a different way. You think about those women lost and starving and destitute, and Naomi is this old widowed woman. She's beyond the years of having kids, beyond the years of going out and working. Spiritually, she is separated out from this umbrella of God's blessing, if you will, this covenant. Ruth, this immigrant girl from a forbidden people, from a nation that you shouldn't have any contact with at all. And there's Boaz, this kind of middle-aged guy that's just a loner, right? He's just doing his thing, no family, nothing to share the joys with, nothing to share the struggles with. They're all kind of out there characters. But I think that connects to us, right? The tough times, the good times, illness, work, school, trouble, death, whatever it is, whatever things come through our lives, somehow, some way, we know we have to trust at least that God is faithful through all of these things. He's doing something else. Even when we don't see the way that it's going to work together, that God is faithful. There's a song I know that says that there may be pain in the night, but joy comes in the morning. I think that's quoted out of Psalm 30, more or less. This is God speaking about lifting up his servant. It starts at verse 3. O Lord, you have brought up my soul from Sheol. You've restored me to life from among those who go down to the pit. Sing praises to the Lord, O you saints, and give thanks for his holy name. For his anger is but for a moment, and his favor is for a lifetime. That weeping may tarry for the night, but joy comes in the morning. Hear, O Lord, and be merciful to me. O Lord, be my helper. You have turned me from mourning into dancing, and have loosed my sackcloth and clothed me with gladness, that my glory may sing your praise and not be silent. O Lord my God, I will give thanks to you forever. Pain in the night, But joy comes in the morning. That God would turn our mourning into dancing, that our hardest times, our toughest struggles, the biggest giants that we face, right, that God would turn those things into joy, right, into dancing, into things to rejoice and celebrate about. And that's kind of the picture that paints through this story of Ruth and Naomi and this child, that all the struggle and all the strife and all the pain comes through, and then there's joy in the morning, right, when the thing comes all the way through to fruition and this child is born, that there's joy that comes from all of the struggle that's been kind of brought up through the whole thing. These characters all had struggles, right? They all had missing pieces in their lives and stuff that wasn't right and stuff that was messed up. And that's the same for us, right? But this invisible hand of God moving through all of it, orchestrating all of it, sorting all of these things out to bring something wonderful from the ashes of the things that were lost. There's a connection to our faith. I think that Boaz kind of presents as something of the anchor in this, right? That he is stable and he's kind of grounded and he's established and he can do things, he can make stuff happen. He's something of this anchor, this unwavering character of persistence. But Ruth really wasn't that different, was she? Like, we see the story of her unfolding that she's pretty persistent of herself. Like, she doesn't take no for an answer. She doesn't sit idly by and wait for something to happen very much. She's a go-getter. You wonder about those characteristics passing on through in the raising of Obed and passing on through to Jesse and then King David and the persistent life that he would lead as the king of Israel. Robert Hubbard, in his commentary on this, said that with generosity, Yahweh rewards those who seek refuge under his wings. I can't imagine that Ruth had any idea as she was moving through these scenes in her life that she was going to be the great-grandmother of a king of Israel, right? Even more so, could she ever imagine that generations later, from her line comes Jesus the Messiah? And we'll make that connection a lot stronger next week. That she's the mother of Obed, who has Jesse, who has David, and Jesse, or David has these two sons, right? Nathan and Solomon, and those two lines land back again with Mary and Joseph, the parents of Christ. No way that Ruth is processing all of that through, like, you know who my great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandson's going to be? You have no idea. That's how it works. Like, we don't know. We don't know what tomorrow's going to be. We don't know what five generations down the line are going to be, right? We are short-sighted. Maybe that's good. With what generosity Yahweh rewards those who seek refuge under his wings. That generous outpouring of God on his people, right? And I'm not talking about stuff. That's too easy. God's not that shallow. Like, we can't fall into that trap to say that God's here to give us new jet planes and sports cars and condos on the ocean and all the things, right, that the world tells us make us substantial. God is far better than that, right? That he would give us things that are lasting, things that matter. His mercy and his grace and his forgiveness to put us into a plan and a purpose and a life that he calls us to in his kingdom forever. There can't be much more of a higher calling than that, I don't think. God's not just providing for Ruth in this story. He's not just providing for Naomi or for Boaz. It's past that into the provision of Israel, of what God is doing and building out this line and this heritage and this legacy that's going to amass into this kingdom of Israel that will stand for a long time and that will produce the Messiah that's going to come to save all of his people forever. The picture, the story is much broader, much greater than any of the people that we see right here. And we have to ask the question, I think, in that, of what is God doing with us? Maybe we don't see it. Maybe we won't ever see it, right? You think about Abraham. He's faithful his whole life and he never sees what God is doing. Not while he's on earth, right? There's a lot of those guys. Moses leads the people for 40 years through the wilderness, and they get right to the edge where you can see the promised land. It's right over there, and he dies. Dang it, you know? But that's what changed my mind from wanting to be a civil engineer when I was a kid, right? I met a civil engineer. His name was Roger. He'd been an engineer for years, for his whole career. And his project, his main project, was the Marcia Sharp Freeway in Lubbock. He'd been working on it since like the 70s or something, like plotting it all the way through And at that time, there wasn't a road there. And I thought, this old man's going to die before they ever build that road. He'll never see it. I don't want to do that. I'll spend my life doing that. That's how it works, right? We don't know what's coming next. We don't know what our legacy is. And I think maybe that's what we need to, maybe something that we need to be thankful for, but also maybe to ask God for some direction. That, like, God, how do I need to live today for what you're doing tomorrow, for what you're doing with my kids or their kids or wherever this thing goes? God, use me to be the instrument of whatever this is shaping out to be. That bigger picture, that we would thank God for what he's doing and what he's building. It's not just today, not next week, but next decade, next century, next whenever that is. I think maybe that should be our prayers. God, use me however you need to use me to do what you're going to do for later. However that is, and that can be maybe terrifying, but hopefully not. That we'd be used of God in that capacity. And that's really all I've got for this one. So what pops to mind for you guys? Let's talk about it. I can't answer questions, but I can try. I can make something up. What sticks out to you guys from that little section of Ruth?
Not bringing the shame and candy for us.
Yeah.
No. Well, 3 days later, I was going to go home. And they said, you can't go home until you name that kid. My friend was in the hospital room. She said, what about Tanner?
No deliberation, no. Like,
no.
It's stuck. It's fun. Yeah. We don't know. I think we still don't really know how it works, right? Like we theorize, maybe. We can put a lot of the parts together, but we can't make the parts, right? And even then, when we put them together, the failure rate's pretty pretty abysmal. Yeah. Yeah.
Advances.
I agree. Like I don't know a whole lot of the, like, I don't know all the details of the new law that they passed in Texas, but that's a big step forward to stopping abortion from being a thing, which is murder. You know? Yeah. It's bad. And that's one kind of persistent thought I've had as, you know, kind of working through this little section, was that we don't attribute the miracle of life to God enough anymore. I mean, in some circles, yes. I mean, we still have, that's not a lost thing, but by and large, as a society, nah. It's modern medicine. We can explain every little step of this. No hand of God. It is. It's all hand of God.
It just reminds you of the joke that God, I don't remember the whole joke, but he was talking about creating this and creating that, and God said, no, go get your own dirt.
Yeah, go get your own dirt.
So life gives the same way.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, you can take these parts that I created already, but go get your own parts.
Yeah. You bet.
Because those parts are the miracle. The watchmaker can make the watch, but he's got to have the parts to make the watch.
Yeah. I mean, ask a farmer, right? Mm-hmm. You know all the parts to put together to make a cotton plant. But you can't will that cotton plant to come out of the ground. Some magic happens in there. Right.
Still doesn't.
Maybe you're not singing enough Mozart to him or something. Mm-hmm. That was... Oh. Pretty incredible. So next week, I think it's the last Sunday of March, isn't it? I'm pretty sure. Because April 3rd is the first Sunday of April. So we'll finish up Ruth. We'll look at that kind of that legacy part of it next week to finish up Ruth. April 3rd is an ordination service, right? Unless Mr. Batty backs out of that. He's not backing out. That's not an option. Then April 10th, we're going to do a little sideshow on creation. April 17th is Easter, so we'll do Easter something there. April 24th, we're going to do a little bit of stuff on the doctrine of mankind. And then I think starting the first Sunday of May, we'll be in Colossians. I think that's the plan, is to work through Colossians. And that'll be a slow walk for sure. So that's confusing.
We meet each week in Floydada, Texas, and welcome you to join us. Learn more at floydadachurch.com, where you can find previous messages, outlines, devotionals for your family to grow deeper in your relationship with the Lord. Now to Him who is able to keep you from stumbling and to present you blameless before the presence of His glory with great joy, to the only God, our Savior, through Jesus Christ, our Lord, be glory, majesty, dominion, and authority before all time and now and forevermore.